Kimura Media Studio.
Hi, Steve there.
This is.
Hey, Steve, this is John Quincy from 1080WKLO.com. How are you?
Very good.
Thank you so much for allowing me to ask you some questions today.
Oh, no problem, actually. I was visiting the website. You've done a terrific job at pulling in all those disparate eras of the station's history and all that. So I don't know what more I can add, but I've got whatever amount of a corner of the world it was at the time. One of the things that I guess sets my little experience at WKLO apart is that I didn't really work there all that long, but I grew up there. Most of the announcers and the jocks that came in to WKLO from the 60s and later came in from other markets, and it was part of their radio career. I grew up with the station growing up in Louisville, so I'm one of the few homegrown people of all the people who have passed through there, one of the few that was actually from the area that then went on, and my radio career went on after that in a gazillion other markets. So I look at it, me, as more of an influence that was early on in my radio career, whereas a lot of guys came, worked for a couple of years, and then they went on. That was the end of it. I had always been a WKLO listener. My best friend that I went to high school with was a Wacky fan, and I was a KLO fan. So we were always at loggerheads with each other about what station was best.
Now, why did you prefer KLO over Wacky?
A couple of reasons. First of all, my dad was actually a disc jockey in Louisville at a number of the dominant Louisville stations in the 1950s. And he had actually worked at WKLO back when it was sort of a network block-programmed station carrying dramas and soap operas and comedy shows and all that stuff back in the 1950s.
What was your dad's name?
His name was Alan Stephens,
okay.
S-T-E-P-H-E-N-S. And he also became the manager of Jimmy Osborne, one of the country singers there. And then there was another country artist called Jimmy Logsdon, who my dad worked with. And then he also worked at WGRC, which is what Wacky was previously before it became Wacky. So I had some radio exposure as my dad was a broadcaster, and I would go to work with him as a kid. And actually, my very first Louisville radio exposure was singing White Christmas on, was either WKLO or WGRC, wherever the studios were, they had an organ and room for a live audience. So I remember going to work with him and a bunch of other folks, and they had me singing White Christmas to this organ accompaniment. And that was, I guess, as a third grader. So I had already known a lot about stations. And when I was in high school, I don't know what you know about the area high schools, but New Albany High School in New Albany, Indiana, has the very first FM station ever owned by a high school in the United States. WNAS 88.1 signed on in 1948. And it set the pace for any other high school radio that was going to come after that. By the time I was going to elementary school and junior high school in Indiana, because I lived in New Albany, we were listening to an FM radio in the classroom every week. There was an FM radio in every classroom of every grade that I ever attended, and part of our week was to listen to radio programs, many of which were produced by the high school students, spelling shows, travel shows, shows about math and school events and sports and stuff, all produced by the seniors at the high school, and we would listen to this. So there's a really rich heritage in radio, and a lot of radio broadcasters have come from that area, and many from the school, including Jack Crawford, who's one of the KLO jocks that came later. And Jack and I were in the same graduating class together at New Albany. But I had all this radio background, and coming from the high school, I was sort of destined to be in broadcasting. Not only was my dad involved with it, but I got on the radio staff at New Albany High School. It was the sort of thing you'd have to audition for, just like you did one of the sports teams, and there was the radio staff, and you got on it. So I did get to do that and was really leaning toward that as a career. So after I finished high school in 1963, I was around knocking on doors to see what kind of radio stations would have me doing anything, cleaning out the ashtrays or whatever there was to do. And I found out that my father knew some people at WKLO, one of which was the general manager at the time named Bill Perry. Bill Perry was the general manager that preceded Ernie Goodridge. I went in and I met with Bill in the Commonwealth Building and introduced myself. And I had some tapes that I had recorded of my work at WNAS at the high school station, and that I was eager to do whatever there was to be done. I really didn't have the experience at that point to get on the air and do a jock shift, certainly at the caliber that one of the top stations in the market at that point. But Bill said that their promotions department was having a summer-long promotion, and he needed to hire somebody to handle doing that promotion, which might involve doing some work on the air from time to time, some remotes and some other things. And the promotion was called the Summer Fun Festival. And the Summer Fun Festival started as soon as school was out, around May or June of 1963. And it ran until school started, Labor Day, the end of the summer. And they rented a vacant store on 4th Street. It had previously been a shoe store, and it had display windows in it. The shoe store went out of business, and it was empty. And then it was rented by Ned Breathitt, when he was a candidate for governor of Kentucky, as his Louisville campaign headquarters. So Ned Breathitt's campaign was being run out of this storefront, and the election came and went, and he won. And so the building was once again empty, and WKLO rented it, and they created a WKLO prize store where they brought in all the prizes that they were going to give away that summer on the Summer Fun Festival and put them in a display case and put them in a store like a retail store. And it was also where people would come pick up their prizes when they won them. There were a few offices in the back of that storefront, and the Breathitt headquarters retained those to do some residual correspondence and mailings and stuff that they had to take care of. So there were still some other people in the back, but they hired me pretty much to run the promotion and to be in the store all day. And I went in the morning and unlocked the place at 9 o'clock, and I would be there in the store till 5 or 6 in the evening. And every hour they would be giving away all kinds of prizes on the air all summer long. And it was things like picnic packages, which we used to call a pick pack, which was some high grades hot dogs and some buns and some Coke and some potato chips and pickles, whatever, in a little container of a picnic package. So we gave away probably 1,000 of those, and all kinds of other prizes, sports equipment, baseball gloves. The grand prize, which sat in the window of the store, was a Honda motorbike. It was what everybody came and registered for, so we had a lot of foot traffic in and out of the store to look at all the prizes and to register, fill out the registration forms. And we would have the drawings of the prizes. I would have the big hopper, and I would pull out the prizes, prize winners every day, and take them down to the studios in the Commonwealth Building so we would know who the next day's names would be. And did all the administrative work, and I wore a WKLO blazer that had the little KLO logo with the Churchill Downs spires on the pocket. They would do occasional drop-ins from down there, phoners. They would call me, and I would tell people if there was certainly something going on at the store. Paul Cowley did the Hi-Fi Club from down there a couple of nights a week when he wasn't doing it at a school. So we did have a lot of foot traffic. We had the jocks that came by, and they would sign autographs and meet people and give away records and that sort of thing. I think having the store downtown from a summer fun festival is one of the reasons that they actually decided to consider using the showcase studio that they built the following year. Once in a great while, I would do a little fill-in work, a few hours on a Sunday morning, or roll the tapes, or play an hour or two DJ shift during some of the religious programming and public service stuff they did on Sunday mornings. But I did get to meet everybody, and I remember the jock lineups. I remember all the folks that worked there. I became very good friends with Jerry Baker, who was also from Indiana, who I later worked with up in Indianapolis, because I worked at Wife. And do you know why he use Larry Baker on the air on WKLO?
No, why is that?
But because opposite him on Wacky, there was a guy named Jerry Barr, and the Wacky Night Show was sponsored by Jerry's Restaurants, and the WKLO Night Show was sponsored by the Ranch House Restaurant, and they didn't want to have a guy named Jerry pitching the Ranch House Restaurants, so they had him change his name to Larry while he worked at WKLO.
Who are some of the other guys that you worked with?
Let's see. Well, Ted Barbone actually had a brief stint as program director, and I worked with a guy that I didn't see on your list anywhere named Frank Malone, who was a tall guy from Texas. He had tape recorders set up to his television set and recorded cartoons, and he would take sound bites from all the cartoon characters and use them as drops on his radio show. And he was a big, tall guy, about 6'4", 6'5", crew cut. It was Frank Malone. And of course, Jim Fletcher was there because he was there for almost ever. Paul Cowley and Larry Baker. Rick Morgan worked nights. And I knew Rick and his wife, Sarah, really became pretty good friends with them. And I went to their home a couple of times. They had a house near Central Park in Louisville. Pat Murphy, the all-night guy, I met on a handful of occasions. And I worked with his brother, Mike Murphy, in Indianapolis. And Barney Groven was, I think, the program director just as I was coming in. And then he was replaced temporarily by this guy named Ted Barbone at the microphone, and then Mitch Michael came in after that. Bob Lyons came and went, and then I think he took PD job over at WINN after that. Bill Crisp worked there briefly during the time that I was at the station. Weekends, Jim Driscoll always worked the weekend shift, and he was around for a long time. Mike Gavin did the middays. He was a heck of a nice guy. Newsroom, I got to know Omar pretty well, Omar Andil. I also knew John Sharp and Ken Rowland and Bob Henry. I was a biology student in high school, and I raised white rats, laboratory rats. I taught them to do all kinds of stuff, and I had these two rats, and I couldn't think of names for them, so I named one of them Omar and the other one Deal. So the two of them together were Omar and Deal. And I called Omar, and I told, this is before I met him. This was when I was still in high school. I called him and told him this story, and he actually wrote it up and used it on the air.
It must have been a slow news day.
Well, you know, they had far too much news for the city the size of Lowell. I mean, they were doing 5, 6, 8, 10 minutes of news every hour, and longer news blocks early in the morning and, you know, at 5 and at 6 o'clock at night than Louisville could ever possibly endure. I don't think they have that much news there now. But I got to be pretty good friends with John Sharp and Omar and Ken Rowland, who later came to New York and came to WMCA when it flipped from Top 40 to Talk. And I actually met up with him here in New York when he first came to the city. There were a lot of people behind the scenes that I met, some of the salespeople that came and went at the station. I remember one of the stalwarts at the station was the receptionist named Fran Oppenheimer. She must have been there for 100 years, and she was really pleasant. And at the Commonwealth Building, I think she made the transition over to the storefront studios on Walnut Street, but I'm not really sure. I remember the hangout, actually, where we would eat lunch, even though there was a Frisch's down the street and all kinds of other places, was right in the Commonwealth Building on the main floor was a restaurant called Hathaway's that had the best chocolate shakes in the whole world. And most of us, people who worked there, would eat in the building, eat at Hathaway's. I know the company at that point was called Air Trails rather than Great Trails. They became Great Trails later. And I later worked with them, with Alex Williams and the Williams family who owned Great Trails, because I was program director at Wing in Dayton a few years later. Those are the names, but my job was pretty much to run that promotion, you know, interact with all the jocks and do some phoners. And the button to the promotion story is that the big finale was the drawing for the Honda motorbike that had been in the window all summer, and it was a huge event, and they had Klieg lights outside, and they broadcast it live, and they announced the grand prize winner. And the grand prize winner was a boy about 15 years old who lived in New Albany, and his name was Ricky Martin. And Rick actually was the son of Don Martin, who owned the radio station WSLM in Salem, Indiana.
You had mentioned Wacky before, and yeah. You prefer WKLO.
Yeah, well, my friend J.L. Embry, we went to high school together in New Albany, and he used to go to Wacky events a lot. And he and I were both magicians. We did magic tricks and stuff together. We even got a job one summer going to Channel 32 and doing the breaks. They did like a monster movie on Saturday nights that was hosted by Tom Perry. There was a newsman at Wacky.
Mm-hmm. I know Tom.
Tom Perryman, whatever. Anyway, we had all of these spider webs and mummy cases and crap that we used to do our magic with, and they would pick us up in a limo. We went over and sold the advertising agency on the idea that their breaks in this monster movie sucked and that we wanted to help them. So we went over and decorated the set, and we'd have hands and bats flying and stuff that we did. We didn't even drive a car. We were both in probably high school freshmen, 15, 14 years old, and they'd send a limo, a car service over to pick us up in New Albany, take us to the TV station on Saturday night, and then we'd do the movie, and then they'd bring us back home. He became a big radio personality himself. He actually ended up working around the Midwest and some other markets as the Wild Child, and eventually went to Baltimore, where he became Johnny Walker, who's probably one of the most talked about radio personalities in the history of Baltimore radio. He just died last year of lung cancer. He retired young, quite young, and lived in West Virginia. But he was the Wacky guy, and he was hanging out with his Wacky buddies, and I was a KLO guy. He was a year behind me in high school, so I had a year ahead of him to get into the workforce. I don't think he ever actually worked at Wacky, but he wrote comedy material and lines and stuff for Jumpin' Jack Sanders. I'm sure was led into ill ways by those guys at Wacky, many of whom were bounced out of town on a rail. There was a whole group of radio guys who had some sort of other industry going on. Barney Groven was involved, and a handful of other people were always supplementing their income in mysterious ways.
Now, you were partial to KLO, but trying to look back objectively, at that time in 1963, was Wacky the top dog, or were things pretty close between the radio stations?
Well, they were pretty close, but you have to remember there were about three or four different rating services at that point. Whether you wanted to buy into, you know, Trendex or Hooper or, you know, whoever else came along. And I'm not sure how the popularity contests were in those days. They didn't have all of these exotic, you know, Arbitron demographics and breakdowns and things like now where you can be number one in this or that and be number four in something else again. But I think that Wacky dominated the top of mind awareness because they literally took a heritage radio station, WGRC, which was, you know, the initials of George Rogers Clark, who explored the area and after whom Clarksville, Indiana was named, and had been this old line station that everybody knew about in this building downtown Louisville with the actual tower on top of the building. It was, you know, pretty impressive, and changed it to Wacky. And they did the Purple People Eater, you know, over and over and over and over again a gazillion times, and a lot of stunting when they first kicked it off, and crazy contests. And that's really the first time Top 40 radio hit Louisville, Kentucky. And as occurred in every other market, you ended up with two players. And WKLO was the other player that got on board and switched into the Top 40 format, but they retained the news department and the public affairs image and the little more broad adult appeal, and Wacky was straight-ahead teenage radio station. I don't think that each station in those days acknowledged each other. It was pretty much everybody kept to their own. There really wasn't a lot of deliberate counter-programming, counter-marketing or whatever. I think there were still a lot of radio stations in the market that were still players. WAVE was still a player. WINN was, you know, still a player in the marketplace. There were only AM stations that mattered at that point. WLOU had the dominant black audience. It really wasn't until later on that FM came in, and there was enough for everybody, but Wacky really went after the teen audience. I'm not sure that the rating services were really up to measuring the teen audience at that point. I think when you got to the mid-60s, once Top 40 Radio figured out what it needed to do, it needed to tighten its playlists, it needed to become less middle of the road. I mean, if you look at the songs on a playlist from the early 60s, you'd have Percy Faith and Elvis on the same playlist. You know, the music that the stations played got better because the music that was being produced for the audience was getting better. So I think about the time Mitch Michael and whatever, just shortly after I left, it really started to focus more in terms of a hot contest. I think I was really right at the edge of when it was going to get serious. But Wacky definitely had a top-of-mind advantage. They were really just everywhere. And WKLO was more, they didn't have to reinvent themselves. They had a lot of residual listenership that had been with the station for many, many years, and they were already in a lot of places in the market. They already were set up to do a lot of annual events and promotions and things. So they had a lot of marketplace goodwill, and they had the call letters, you know, in the marketplace. Wacky started the day that the call letters changed and WGRC became Wacky. WKLO had been WKLO for decades before it ever switched to Top 40. I mean, even on your website, you have pictures of people that came to the reunion that you had, like Pee Wee King and people like that, who had no real affiliation with the radio station other than back in its days when it played country music, and the country music heritage in Louisville is very deep. I worked part-time, ultimately, at WTMT, and I worked with people like Tommy Downs and Ginger Callahan, and WKLO had been around for a very, very long time. It was already in the marketplace, and the call letters were well-known. And I'm sure it was to some people's chagrin that they actually changed to Top 40, but it really didn't have the abrupt impact that Wacky did, because Wacky's history only goes back to when Wacky became Wacky. And there were people that were teenagers that started listening to WKLO as a Top 40 station, but their parents had listened to WKLO as something else. So the station had been on, you know, in the car, in the home, in the garage, whatever, wherever the radio would have been on, while a lot of people were growing up. I think maybe that's probably true in my case because the station was around a lot and it was just a natural progression. It wasn't, oh, surprise, here's a new radio station, let's go listen to it. It was just there, and we kind of grew along with it. I remember listening to how different the two stations were overnight, because if I would stay up past midnight on weekends or any time during the week that I was still awake past midnight, Wacky didn't have an all-night jock for quite a while. They had an automated service, an automated thing, which they called Sam Seberg, which was sort of a electronic Sonovox type voice that just played songs. And that was their nighttime jock. Whereas WKLO had Pat Murphy, who was total personality and funny. It was really interesting to flip back and forth between the two stations during the daytime when they would sound pretty much alike, but yet at night you could flip back and forth and they would sound so totally different. It was like night and day. I don't think Wacky ever did much on the Indiana side. I think they concentrated more on the Jefferson County, Louisville side of things. WKLO's towers are in New Albany, still there. Big four-tower array on some of the prettiest property in Floyd County. Someday, if they ever take those towers down, it's going to be a land rush for that territory. I don't know if you've ever seen where they are or not. My mother lives about a mile away from there. You can see them practically from the top of her house. And I think the fact that the transmitter building was right on a very busy street and was always emblazoned with the WKLO call letters, the logo on it, that there was a warm spot for the people on the Indiana side for the WKLO station. I remember once that I won a Valentine's contest that WKLO had. Jerry Baker delivered a dozen roses to my house. It must have been when I was still like maybe a freshman or something in high school. So that's the first time I met him when I won this Valentine's contest. Right after I left the radio station, the Summer Fun Festival, they put on a new AM station in Corydon, Indiana, which is WPDF at 1550. And I went up there, which was only about 35 miles down the road, and they hired me to do afternoons. So I was literally working in Corydon for probably the next 6 or 7 months, and then I was going to school at IU Southeast, which had campuses in Jeffersonville at the time. Now they're in New Albany. So I was pretty much going to school and then running 5 days a week down to Corydon to do afternoon drive, and I only did that for about a year, and then I moved away to Florida, got completely out of the Kentuckiana area. I moved to Florida, where my aunt owned a radio station. Like I said, my dad was a DJ. Well, his sister, my aunt, actually owned a station, was a manager of a station in Punta Gorda, Florida. And I went down there and worked afternoon drive for her station, and I got my first-class license at one of those six-week first-class license schools in Sarasota. That's why I went. I said, if I'm going to get anywhere, I'm going to have to get that first-class license because at least I'll get a crappy shift, but I'll end up on the air somewhere. Maybe it's overnight. And that's precisely what happened. I did go to Florida, and I did work for her station. I had did afternoon drive. I worked on my technique. I got a lot of good air check time. I got part-time job at a station in Sarasota, got my first-class license, and then I left. Then I went to Indianapolis, and I was in Indianapolis for 5 years. So right at the time that Wacky and WKLO were starting to gel and become real live adult top billing radio stations, I bailed out of the marketplace. So that's when the Lee Grays and the other guys, you know, who came through there, and then I was no longer around. So I look at a lot of these pictures and I see people that I know from the radio industry because I've been in radio for 150 years, but I never knew that they worked at WKLO because they came after I did, and I wasn't in the marketplace, only rarely even visiting. Even though I still had family there, I was pretty much in and out quickly. And I moved to New York in 1970. And the only time I've left New York has been to take PD jobs in Dayton and San Antonio and Albany and a few other places. This has been home really since the early 70s.
Well, Steve, thank you so much. I appreciate your time and your memories. You filled in a lot of gaps, even though you weren't one of the major personalities
there.
Well,
sometimes it takes being a fly on the wall to see what's going on, you know, in the room. And I had a good perspective of it without really being polarized by any one place that I had to be. So it was fun. And I still do keep in touch with a couple of people like Dale Reeves and some other folks, and we remember those days quite well. And I appreciate your website at prodding my memory on some of these other things.